Chapter 9. Reveries. And I thought with some sadness that all these revolts and indignations, all these protests, revulsions of feeling, pangs of suffering and of rage, expressed but the uneasiness of sensual beings trying for their share in the joys of form, color, sensations, the only riches of our world of senses. A poet may be a simple being, but he is bound to be various and full of wiles, ingenious and irritable. I reflected on the variety of ways the ingenuity of the late bard of civilization would be able to invent for the tormenting of his dependents. Poets not being generally foresighted in practical affairs, no vision of consequences would restrain him. Yes, the Fines were excellent people, but Mrs. Fine wasn't the daughter of a domestic tyrant for nothing. There were no limits to her revolt. But they were excellent people. It was clear that they must have been extremely good to that girl whose position in the world seemed somewhat difficult, with her face of a victim, her obvious lack of resignation and the bizarre status of orphan, oh, a certain extent. Such were my thoughts, but in truth I soon ceased to trouble about all these people. I found that my lamp had gone out, leaving behind an awful smell. I fled from it up the stairs, and went to bed in the dark. My slumbers, I suppose the one good in pedestrian exercise, confound it, is that it helps our natural callousness. My slumbers were deep, dreamless, and refreshing. My appetite at breakfast was not affected by my ignorance of the facts, motives, events, and conclusions. I think that to understand everything is not good for the intellect. A well-stocked intelligence weakens the impulse to action. An overstocked one leads gently to idiocy. But Mrs. Fine's individualist woman doctrine, naively unscrupulous, flitted through my mind. The salad of unprincipled notions she put into these girlfriends' heads. Good innocent creature, worthy wife, excellent mother of the strict governess type, she was as guileless of consequences as any determinist philosopher ever was. As to honor, you know it's a very fine medieval inheritance which women never got hold of. It wasn't theirs. Since it may be laid as a general principle that women always get what they want, we must suppose they didn't want it. In addition, they are devoid of decency. I mean masculine decency. Cautiousness too is foreign to them, the heavy reasonable cautiousness which is our glory. And if they had it, they would make of it a thing of passion, so that its own mother, I mean the mother of cautiousness, wouldn't recognize it. Prudence with them is a matter of thrill like the rest of sublunary contrivances. Sensation at any cost is their secret device. All the virtues are not enough for them, they want also all the crimes for their own. And why? Because in such completeness there is power, the kind of thrill they love most. Do you expect me to agree to all this? I interrupted. No, it isn't necessary, said Marlowe, feeling the check to his eloquence, but with a great effort at amiability. Who need not even understand it? I continue. With such disposition, what prevents women, to use the phrase an old boatswain of my acquaintance applied descriptively to his captain, what prevents them from roaming on deck, and playing hell with the ship generally, is that something in them precise and mysterious, acting both as restraint and as inspiration, their femininity in short, which they think they can get rid of by trying hard, but can't, and never will. Therefore we may conclude that, for all their enterprises, the world is, and remains safe enough. Feeling, in my character of a lover of peace, soothed by that conclusion, I prepared myself to enjoy a fine day. And it was a fine day, a delicious day, with the horror of the infinite veiled by the splendid tent of blue, a day innocently bright like a child with a washed face. Fresh like an innocent young girl, suave in welcoming one's respects like a Roman prelate. I love such days. They are perfection for remaining indoors. And I enjoyed it temperamentally in a chair, my feet upon the sill of the open window, a book in my hands and the murmured harmonies of wind and sun in my heart making an accompaniment to the rhythms of my author. Then looking up from the page, I saw outside a pair of gray eyes thatched by ragged yellowy white eyebrows gazing at me solemnly over the toes of my slippers. There was a grave, furrowed brow surmounting that portentous gaze, a brown tweed cap set far back on the perspiring head. "Come inside," I cried as heartily as my sinking heart would permit. After a short, but severe scuffle with his dog at the outer door, Fine entered. I treated him without ceremony and only waved my hand towards a chair. Even before he sat down, he gasped out, "We've heard Midday Post." Gasped out. The grave, immovable Fine of the civil service, gasped. This was enough, you'll admit, to cause me to put my feet to the ground swiftly. That fellow was always making me do things in subtle discord with my meditative temperament. No wonder that I had but a qualified liking for him. I said with just a suspicion of jeering tone. "Of course. I told you last night on the road that it was a farce we were engaged in." He made the little parlor resound to its foundations with a note of anger positively sepulchral in its depth of tone. "Arse be hanged. As he has bolted with my wife's brother, Captain Anthony." This outburst was followed by complete subsidence. He faltered miserably as he added from force of habit, "He son of the poet, you know." A silence fell. Fine's several expressions were so many examples of varied consistency. This was the discomfiture of solemnity. My interest, of course, was revived. "But hold on," I said. "They didn't go together. Is it a suspicion, or does she actually say that?" "Dot, as he has gone after him," stated Fine in comminatory tones. "Why previous arrangement?" "She confesses that much." He added that it was very shocking. I asked him whether he should have preferred them going off together, and on what ground he based that preference. This was sheer fun for me in regard of the fact that Fine's 2 was a runaway match, which even got into the papers in its time, because the late indignant poet had no discretion, and sought to avenge this outrage publicly in some absurd way before a Buick judge. The dejected gesture of little Fine's hand disarmed my mocking mood. But I could not help expressing my surprise that Mrs. Fine had not detected at once what was brewing. Women were supposed to have an unerring eye. He told me that his wife had been very much engaged in a certain work. I had always wondered how she occupied her time. It was in writing. Like her husband, she too published a little book. Much later on, I came upon it. It had nothing to do with pedestrianism. It was a sort of handbook for women with grievances and all women at them, a sort of compendious theory and practice of feminine free morality. It made you laugh at its transparent simplicity. But that authorship was revealed to me much later. I didn't, of course, ask Fine what work his wife was engaged on, but I marveled to myself at her complete ignorance of the world, of her own sex, and of the other kind of sinners. Yet, where could she have got any experience? Her father had kept her strictly cloistered. Marriage with Fine was certainly a change, but only to another kind of claustration. You may tell me that the ordinary powers of observation ought to have been enough. Why, yes. But then, as she had set up for a guide and teacher, there was nothing surprising for me in the discovery that she was blind. That's quite in order. She was a profoundly innocent person, only it would not have been proper to tell her husband so. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.